Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you?
I'm well, but I'm concerned.
Well, I'm usually well, and I'm usually concerned.
There's an issue that I think deserves some talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, New York City passed a law, passed an ordinance that required fast food restaurants with a certain number of restaurants in the chain that served standardized portions of food across the chain to list the caloric content and some limited nutritional information on their menus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it exempted family restaurants, mom and pop, standalones,
sure,
restaurants that, you know, have a different special every day, change things, because that makes sense. Look, I don't whether you're for or against I think there are good arguments for and against having fast food chains tell you how many calories are in their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that onerous for a fast food chain.
Because you're going to sell a 100 million quarter pounders with cheese.
Right. So if it costs you even $1,000,
mm-hmm,
to, if you're McDonald's.
Even $10,000.
If you're McDonald's. Or even if you're a chain that has 40 stores and,
mm-hmm,
it costs you $1,000 to figure out what your thing costs. But, again, it's a standardized thing across all your stores and it doesn't change. You know, I think that's there's a burden on business there that may or may not be reasonable, but, you know, it's a judgment call, I,
mm-hmm,
think. I don't know where I stand on it, to be honest with you. But certainly if you have a mom-and-pop restaurant, we go to the Green Market in the afternoon, we come back,
right,
to the restaurant that night, and we come up with, when we change our menu, we print our menu in-house, and it changes all the time.
And it may change from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock if the chives don't look good on,
right,
a certain night, or if, you know, we talk about, having a standard menu. My menu is so not standard that the caloric count in the, let's say, the Alaskan king salmon may have a higher calorie count,
sure,
than the line-caught California coho salmon.
Right, because there's a higher content in that one salmon over the other.
In basically one salmon or the other, or week to week based on where the salmon is on the river. There are so many things that are going in when you're talking about food on when it's not being mass produced like this. I wouldn't even begin to know what the difference is as the owner of the restaurant.
You would need to send it out for laboratory analysis.
Absolutely.
But by the time the analysis got back, you'd be onto a different kind of salmon.
Salmon would be bad.
Exactly. And, you know, people say, oh, well, just guess. What's the big deal? Here's the deal. If you're telling me that I can put numbers up for caloric content, but they don't have to be accurate, well, then what do we do? What are we doing?
What's the point of that?
Okay, you have to put the caloric content up there. And let's face it. Restaurants are the targets of frivolous lawsuits. We're a favorite target of frivolous,
mm-hmm,
lawsuits. So I'm going to put the caloric content up there to the best that I can figure it out. It's going to be wrong by 50 calories.
Right.
And somebody's going to sue me. And so that's why the mom and pops really can't do this. And I'm not saying that the big chain should have to. I'm saying there's a debate. I think there's,
mm-hmm,
a legitimate debate out there. But your individual restaurants cannot do this. It's onerous. Anyway, the United States District Court in New York voided the city ordinance, said you can't do that. You can't say
chain restaurants have to have one, right, have to abide by one set of laws and non-chain restaurants.
You can't discriminate among the different kind of restaurants. Now, I sort of understand that.
Right,
as
I don't think that's completely unreasonable.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that's a gray area. Well, Mayor Bloomberg has come out and said, all right then, we're going to make all restaurants in New York. He has now said publicly that he's determined that all restaurants in New York will have to put the caloric content on the menu. Now, that's just stupid. That's just – and
right,
it's unworkable, and it's going to hurt business. It'll never pass.
I mean, frankly, now you don't necessarily want this to be the case because I want – when I'm serving my whatever dish, let's say, I want the butter content to be the same no matter what. But you know what? If the – if the fish for some reason isn't particularly rich that day, maybe I'm going to put some more butter in that dish to change that recipe. You know, in a second, and what I want, and what I'm hiring artists, I'm hiring artisans. What I want them to do is interpret what they're seeing. I mean, let's take a cocktail example, okay? If limes aren't as sweet right now, my bartenders know that they have to add a tiny little bit more simple syrup to the cocktail than they would if limes are if limes are in season and limes are a little sweeter. Well, those ingredients can and should change all the time based on the other ingredients around them.
And frankly, even if we didn't change them, even if we only change things seasonally like many restaurants do, it's hugely onerous to send something out for laboratory analysis to find out exactly what the cost is going to be. And even if you change it four times a year, my point is, and frankly, look, if it's up there on the big board on the McDonald's or the Burger King, again, I don't know where I stand on that. I think it's, the information should be available from standardized restaurants. But if you go to your really nice dinner and you open the menu and it says, you know, at Le Bec Fan in Philadelphia or at Moto in Chicago or at Per Se in New York or the French Laundry in California, and you open this beautiful handwritten menu that has the tasting menu on it, and it has the number of calories, amount of trans fats. It looks like a Campbell's soup label.
Except at Moto, you'd actually have to have a caloric content on the menu because the menu is edible.
That's funny. A little foodie joke you had there going on. That's great. Seven people are laughing, and they're all chefs.
I'm one of them, though. Thank goodness.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think this is onerous and a problem, and if anybody wants to give Mayor Bloomberg's office a call, I understand that he doesn't understand what that means to a small business, but it is so onerous as to be unworkable. And that's why, frankly, I'm not upset about it, because I don't think it can pass. Because in New York, we love our restaurants in New York. You know, I think they said that there are 1.2 full-service restaurant seats for every person in Manhattan. In other words, if everybody in Manhattan went out to dinner and nobody from the outer boroughs came in, you'd still have a 20% vacancy, more or less.
Well, and I also think that people now, you know, people who listen to this show especially, but even the middle of the market is moving this way. We don't want to see things that are cookie cutter, that are exactly the same time after time after time after time. We want our artisans and people to learn, who've learned this skill and these skills, to adapt, to change, to interpret those differences.
But let's remember where this is coming from and where Mayor Bloomberg is coming from here, and the advocates of this proposition are coming from. They're coming from a position that says, A, we want people to be healthier. I agree. B, we want to give the consumer as much information as possible. I agree.
Right.
Where I disagree is that this is unworkable, and what we also want is for individuals to be able to operate restaurants and people to make healthy choices and ad hoc choices and go to the green market and figure out what they want to make and then come back that night and make it. And this makes that impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the motivation for wanting to pass this comes from a good place.
Right.
However, the end net result will be fewer restaurants that have healthy food, and just more restaurants that have bad food will tell you how bad it is.
Right. I mean, we do want to eliminate cars that use gasoline. We don't want to eliminate restaurants that use really good food.
Yeah.
No, I'm saying, as far as an analogy goes, you know, people talk about, you know, getting rid of gasoline or changing that, and the car makers will answer, or the gasoline manufacturers, well, that'll be onerous to our business. Well, you know what? Change your business then.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a business we want to change.
Right. No, exactly. And it will change the business in unintended ways that actually may make it worse overall. So call Mayor Bloomberg and let him know that you don't like it. All right. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, from Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Gary Allen is a food writer, a professor at the State University of New York's Empire State College. He's the author of The Resource Guide for Food Writers and, most recently, the reference book The Herbalist in the Kitchen.
Gary, welcome to the show.
Oh, how you doing?
We're doing well. How are you today?
Gary, this is quite a tome you have, 484 pages of herbs.
Right. It makes an excellent bookstop, doorstop.
Yeah, it does. Well,
you know, Gary, this show is a lot about, we have on very frequently authors who have written books and recipes and things like that, but yours is not really a recipe book. More is a reference guide.
Correct.
Let's talk about how you organized the book and why you organized it that way.
Okay. I originally wanted to have recipes in there for all the herbs, but there are thousands of them, and the book would have to be in a whole encyclopedia.
Well, it's already 484 pages, so that at least 900-page book is what you would have created.
Oh, much more than that. So, really, the book is about components of food, because, you know, recipes go in and out of fashion, but the things that we make the recipes from don't.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to address that kind of issue.
Now, is this a reference guide that you intended for the home cook, the professional chef, the pharmacist? Who is this designed for?
It's for professional chefs and for people who are serious about exploring old recipes and ethnic recipes, where they might come across ingredients that they've never heard of.
Well, you know, you bring up a good point there. We did the first American cookbook was widely attributed to a woman named Amelia Simmons, who in 1796, was it?
Right about there.
Yeah, it was 1796, because in 1996 we celebrated the 200th anniversary of the Amelia Simmons cookbook by running a menu that had some of her recipes in it. So in researching these old recipes from a 200-year-old cookbook, there were a number of challenges for us, and one of them was to translate the measurements that she used, like a wine glass of sherry. Well, how big was the wine glass?
Correct.
And the other thing that is sometimes difficult in referring to historical recipes is they'll use herbs that we don't use anymore, or sometimes call the herb by a different name than it's currently known.
Right. Common names are always a problem, which is why for each herb, I've listed as many of the common names as I could possibly find. Obviously, that's going to make it hard to find things because it's just a huge number of them.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm working on right now is Google is in the process of scanning the book.
Oh, great.
And I'm going to put online a search engine that will find any word in the book.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Which means, obviously, you know, if I had such an index in this book, again, it would be many more volumes.
Well,
but that way people can actually track down anything that they come across.
Now, have you figured out a way that you can get a quarter every time somebody does that?
Would that I could.
You know, you talk about all the different names for herbs, but I think sometimes people don't realize that something, you know, summer sorrel has different names to it. You know,
correct.
Talk to us about some of those differences that people might be familiar
with. Yeah, and also about, just to elaborate on that question, you must have had to look into the cultural contexts of these different words and recipes and herbs, or the same herbs cross-culturally.
Hundreds and hundreds of books. Yes, I did a lot of that.
And do you find that the herbs are attributed, you either use differently in different cultures, or different properties are attributed to those herbs culturally in different cultures?
Oh, certainly. Perfect example is cilantro.
Mm-hmm.
European cooking has used coriander seeds forever.
Coriander is the seed of cilantro, for the record.
Correct. But it's only in the last couple of decades that cilantro, the leafy part of the plant, has been used in Western cooking. When you're talking about common names, there's a very interesting thing. The name cilantro modifies itself in different places into culantro, cilantro, and so on. And what I think happened is as Westerners moved around the Caribbean and Gulf of Mexico area, they carried with it the name and then used different plants for the same use in cooking.
I see.
So the name got applied according to how it was used. So there you have all these different plants with the same name.
Really?
Yeah.
So cilantro isn't always the same plant?
Right. Culantro and cilantro may be the same and may not be, depending on where it comes from.
Boy, that makes it hard.
Somebody should write a book to keep this all straight. When we come back, I want to talk about something that I'm sure to hold people over the commercial break so that they come back and join us again. When we come back, we're going to talk about the aphrodisiac and other medicinal properties of herbs. We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Gary Allen. His book is The Herbalist in the Kitchen, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:24.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Our guest today is Gary Allen. His book is The Herbalist in the Kitchen. It's a unique reference work that if you're interested at all in herbs, and if you're cooking, you should be interested in herbs, you should have on your kitchen shelf. It's amazing. One of the things that you talk about is the different medicinal properties that are attributed to herbs. Are there herbs that act as, let's go with the sexiest one first, an aphrodisiac?
Technically, no.
You're such a party pooper, Gary.
No, actually, the way virtually all aphrodisiacs work is a kind of placebo effect.
Uh-huh.
If you want it to work, it will work.
So, but now that you've told me that, it means that no aphrodisiacs will ever work on me. You bastard. Sorry.
Sorry. Well, on the other hand, they're still fun to eat.
Okay, all right. Then. So, but are there there are medicinal effects in herbs. A lot of our modern pharmaceuticals come from things that have been isolated from traditional herbal medicines.
Quinine, for instance, out of tree bark.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So
talk to us about that, Gary.
Okay. First of all, there's two basic categories of medicinal herbs. The ones that work and the ones that don't work.
Excellent.
Right?
I love that. You get right down to business, don't you?
Right. The ones that work, probably people already know about and doctors already use. The ones that don't work may work anyway, again, with the placebo effect, if you believe them to work.
Mm-hmm.
And people use different herbs because of different properties. For instance, if an herb looks like the part of the body that's supposed to affect, people think it'll work. Hepatica. Looks like a liver. The leaves look like the shape of a liver, so people thought that it worked on livers.
That's really dumb.
Right. If it looks like a part of the body that might be sexual, then you would think that it has aphrodisiac properties.
Again, really dumb.
Clove is a perfect example.
And clove was thought to have aphrodisiacal qualities?
Yeah. Also, all the sweet
hot spices. I always thought that about Lucky Shamrocks, but yeah. I guess that's...
however you get lucky.
Right. Well,
the hot sweet spices tend to be regarded as aphrodisiacs, no doubt, because hot and sweet is suggestive. But the interesting thing about cloves is cloves have a compound called eugenol in them that it gives it a hot numbing quality.
Mm-hmm.
And there are products sold to improve the quality of sexual experience that are essentially salves containing eugenol.
Hmm.
And they're applied to the appropriate part of the body, and they actually numb it a little bit.
Oh.
Makes you last longer.
Right, to slow things down. Calm down, buggo.
Right.
I got it.
Which I think is really interesting because the term for that is anesthetic, which means not aesthetic. Which is really a delightful word.
Hey, you know, I got one other thing that we just found out from a guy named Stephen Witherly, who is a great food scientist and PhD. He has found that black pepper, if you take black pepper before you take Viagra, it actually increases the rate and speed at which your body absorbs Viagra and keeps your liver from knocking it down. Isn't that really...
That is interesting.
Isn't that wild?
I wonder if it's just because the black pepper sort of increases the absorption rate of things.
I have no idea, no need to, and fortunately, no need to know just yet. But we'll see what happens in the rest of my life.
You know, it's like adding caffeine to aspirin turns it into Excedrin, and basically all it does is it gets the aspirin into your system faster.
Mm-hmm. I did not know that again. All right, we'll be back after the news talking more with Gary Allen. The Herbalist in the Kitchen is his book. You can find it at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. WCTC 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Our guest today is Gary Allen. His book is The Herbalist in the Kitchen. It's a completely comprehensive guide on herbs. It's 479 pages that you can use in your kitchen. Gary, this is, it's a reference work. One of the things that I find very interesting here is for any cook that's looking to make either a historical recipe or to sort of change recipes around a bit, you identify in this book the underlying compounds that cause the spice or the herb to have the taste and smell that it has. Some of these compounds turn up in other spices as well. Can people use this book to learn how to substitute one spice for another, or maybe add another spice that's in the same family? Talk to us about how spices are related flavor-wise and family-wise.
Absolutely, yeah. It's very interesting. The compounds that give herbs and spices their flavors and smells are not specific to particular families or anything like that. They could come up anywhere. So, like for instance, we talked about cloves before. They contain eugenol. Eugenol also appears in allspice, and in bay leaves, and in some varieties of basil,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you don't happen to have cloves, you might want to use one of those other things, which is going to give you slightly different flavors because they have other compounds as well. But it's a great way to sort of have a recipe morph into new recipes.
Well, and that's the thing. It's also not just when you're in a pinch. You know, that's sort of the necessity being the mother of invention. But if
right.
you want to take a recipe and twist it a little bit and make it your own, find something with those compounds that's slightly different and maybe that calls for cloves, but you use basil and you'll get a good result. But that's a good place to start.
The other thing.
Another example is, a lot of people put chives in mashed potatoes,
mm-hmm.
and people also like garlic mashed potatoes. If you use Chinese flat-leaf chives, they have a garlicky flavor as well, so you could get it all at one time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, a lot of things in those families are I don't want to say interchangeable, but certainly can add some of the same complexity.
Oh, sure.
You know, in substituting some of these things, one of the things, and when you look at things, herbs, basically from what's in them and what the compounds are in them, you have to be careful. And one of the things I read in your book is that some of these compounds, even in very, very, very small amounts, really are very pungent.
Correct.
So let's talk about the pungency of some of these, some of the compounds in one part per million we perceive.
Right. Closely related to that is the different compounds in these herbs evaporate and volatilize and go away at different rates. So say you have fresh tarragon, which has a wonderful anise-like taste.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever had dry tarragon, you notice that doesn't seem to be there.
Right.
It has more like a dried hay kind of flavor. And the reason is the anisole, the compound that gives it that anise flavor, evaporates very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So when people talk about substituting dry herbs for fresh herbs, it's not just the amounts. The flavor profile, the actual taste of the thing changes as well.
Sure. I mean, when we cook in the restaurant with dried herbs, almost always, the maxims are you want to use dried herbs early on and you want to use fresh herbs right at the end.
Right.
Just because of some of that volatility that
right.
you're talking about.
But, even the dry herb itself will no longer mm-hmm. have the qualities that the other one had.
One of the things that I found was interesting in your book is that you said that human senses, especially the sense of smell, are often much more sensitive than routine chemical analysis. A barely measurable trace of one substance can have a disproportionate effect on the way we perceive it. So you're saying that the human nose is sometimes more a better judge than a normal routine chemical analysis?
Well, in the sense that the numbers that you see may not be meaningful.
Right.
Right. Something might only be one part per million, but because the nose is so sensitive, it may pick that up a lot more than something that has 1,000 parts per million.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about, our noses were originally developed to help us find food and avoid danger. Okay. We add herbs to food to enhance flavor. We don't get a lot of nutrition from most herbs. I think
most herbs, you don't eat enough of them to get the effect.
Right. Mm-hmm. The exceptions you had in your book were sorrel and
purslane.
And purslane, right.
Because sometimes you eat them like a salad.
Right.
A large mm-hmm. quantity of them.
Or a sorrel soup or something.
Right.
But there are dangers out there. Like, you know, there's the mushroom and the toadstool. One's delicious. One's the Grim Reaper. What are the dangers with herbs out there? I mean, herbs have been used to make poisons as well as medicines.
Oh, sure.
So talk to us about the dangers in herbs.
For instance, if you look at the ingredients for a lot of the liqueurs, like Benedictine, for instance, they have a large number of herbs in them, herbs and spices, sometimes up to 130.
Sure, Campari is another one.
Yeah. Yeah, Campari is one, Chartreuse, mm-hmm. another. And a lot of them contain something called arnica. Arnica, it was used in the Middle Ages to add a little bit of flavor, but it was used in very tiny amounts. If people thought that they could use arnica just because they saw it in the list of their recipes, a list of ingredients in one of those liqueurs, they could very easily get in trouble.
What now? What does arnica do, and is it just that there's not enough of it in that to her, in the Benedictine?
Yeah, there's a very tiny amount in there.
So
it adds a slight bitterness, but nowadays arnica is only used externally for wounds. You don't eat it.
So if I look at it on my Benedictine, if I looked it up and saw that wasn't present in my Benedictine, and then I made an arnica soup or put it in my salad,
you'd be in trouble.
That'd be bad for me.
Yeah.
What other kind of dangers lurk out there in the world of herbs?
It's usually related to the amounts.
Mm-hmm.
There's all these chemical compounds in there that all have different effects. We're familiar with some. For instance, alcohol is a poison if taken in the right amounts. And we've
wrong amounts, you mean, not
well,
the right
yeah.
amounts.
Well, depending on what your goal is. but our culture, we've learned how to deal with it. You know, we have sort of standard-sized drinks, and we've learned how to tell when we're getting in trouble, most of us.
Yeah, I was going to say,
right.
Yeah, I've met some guys who don't know how to tell when they're in trouble.
Yeah, but culturally, we learned how to deal with it. In the South Sea Islands, they eat a lot of plants that would be toxic if they're not treated properly. You know, and they've learned culturally how to boil it and strain off the liquid and
like
do what they have to do.
What kind of plant do they eat that would be toxic if ingested raw?
Cassava. Cassava by itself could be very dangerous.
Uh-huh. What does cassava do to you?
I'm not exactly sure. But
bad things.
It's not good.
Well, I think one that most people here in the Northeast or in the United States would be familiar with would be something like rhubarb.
Oh,
where,
sure.
Where part of the plant is toxic and part of the plant is not toxic.
Right.
Or a potato, if you let it...
If you let it get green, you're going to have some gastric distress.
Chiming in from the Irish expertise on potatoes, where I am.
I thought you were chiming in from the gastric distress. So
we've learned to avoid the green potatoes. It's the only thing green we don't have, like in Ireland, is the green potatoes. But you point to... bay leaves, as an example, they're in the laurel family, but all
right.
the other laurel leaves would be poisonous.
Right. For instance, you know, the common plant around here is mountain laurel,
uh-huh.
which
mm-hmm.
is not related at all. The leaves look the same. It's not related at all. It's incredibly toxic.
Well, that's the problem with a lot of the things in the laurel family. They look just like bay leaves, but
right.
you know, you're going to kill yourself.
You want to know where it comes from.
Yeah, that's wild. You know, the other thing that's interesting about bay leaves is... bay leaves are one of those things that you use as a seasoning, and then it doesn't. You take the bay leaf out, or someone's going to choke
right.
on it. Also toxic, I guess, if you choke on it. But the other thing about bay leaves that the home cook needs to know is cooking with alcohol. Alcohol has a great role in cooking, and the substances in bay leaves are not readily soluble in water. So if you throw bay leaves into your soup and there's no sort of a winy or acid base,
right, no acidity.
You're not going to extract a lot of flavor.
One of the reasons it goes great in tomato sauce is the acidity in the tomato sauce really brings out the flavor in the bay leaves.
And also
right.
it's very...
Also the oil, the uh-huh. olive oil will help.
And it's very
a lot of these things are oil soluble.
Well, and a lot of and in the bay leaves, it's very soluble in alcohol. So if
right.
you put that bay leaf in with some red wine to get it started, you're going to get a lot more of what it is that you want out of the herbs. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Gary Allen. His book is The Herbalist in the Kitchen, and we're going to talk about herbs and how you can use them at home and some techniques that you can use to get maximum benefit from them for the home cook and also for the professional chef. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:45.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys of Captain Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest is Gary Allen. His book is The Herbalist in the Kitchen. You should pick it up at restaurantguysradio.com. It's a 500-page reference work on spices. And look, when you cook at home, the great food is about, number one, the appropriate level of salt, and number two, make it getting the spicing right. That's what it's all about, and it's about using spices and using them well.
A lot of mistakes that I see home cooks make when they're making their food at home is you're not, well, salt, Francis already talked about, but you're not using enough herbs, and you're not using them at the right time, and you're not using the right types of herbs to marry with each other.
When you talk about these herbs in your book, Gary, we just talked about Bailey's a moment ago and how to, you know, extract the best flavor out of them. Can people learn by looking in your book? How are some ideas for using them? I know there are no recipes in your book, but how to best extract the flavor? How different cultures extract the flavor from these herbs? Can they?
Absolutely. A perfect example is one that, you know, a lot of people don't think about here, but is very big in the Middle East, and that's sumac, not poison sumac, but red sumac. Red sumac berries have a lot of malic acid, which is the same flavoring that you get in green apples, that tart thing. They also have a lot of tannins, which are very bitter. So if you want to get the apple taste, the green apple taste, without the bitter tannins, you soak the berries in cold water first so the tannins are not released. Strain it off, and then you can either concentrate that, the resulting liquid, you know, reduce it, or, you know, do whatever you want to do with it. You know, you can make sort of a lemonade-like drink with it. But that way you don't get the tannins.
But might some people want the tannin?
Well, yeah, but it, you know, they have so much tannins in them that you could literally tan leather with it.
We're not in the leather tanning business. It's a restaurant show. With the fashion show, the clothing show, will be calling you about that. The other thing that I was most interested in, and I really, I know it's just an accident of the alphabet, but I adore that you started the book with agave, which is the main ingredient in tequila. Perfect.
Right.
Talk to us about agave.
Oh, agave is fascinating. You know, people think of it as a cactus. It's not really. It's a succulent. But agave.
I'm sorry. Can you define?
It's used for making tequila and mezcal.
Can you define succulent for us?
Succulents are plants that grow in very arid areas. And they have very thick skins to keep as much of the water in them as possible. So they tend to have thick, juicy leaves.
And I'd just like to interject that you should not confuse this with a succubus, which is a female demon that comes to you in the middle of the night. No relation.
Correct.
Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
For a while there, mezcal was popular because people could eat the worm at the bottom of the bottle.
Understood that.
Well, somebody asked me why that worm is there. Why is the worm there? Is it just for macho purposes? And it's not. It turns out that if you put a worm in the bottle and you fill it up with mezcal that doesn't have a high enough alcohol content, the worm will decompose. if the worm is preserved, that means the alcohol content is high enough. So it's actually a sort of primitive measure of proof.
So what we don't want are decomposed worms in the bottom of our medicine.
If you thought a worm was bad, a decomposed worm.
The worms themselves have some use. In Mexico, they make a spice called worm salt.
Yeah.
And what they take those agave worms, and they toast them, and then grind them up with salt and some chili peppers, and use that as a seasoning.
Toasted worm. Get me some more of that.
It has exactly the taste of tequila without the alcohol.
Really?
Yeah.
What's the point?
You know, it's wonderful.
I'm sorry.
You're missing the point, right?
Right. No. Well, I said, if it's the taste of tequila without the alcohol, what's the point? I say that tongue in cheek because actually we serve a lot of mezcal and tequila at the restaurants, and there are some amazing flavors that are in that.
Yeah.
But tell us how. So we know that people use agave to make tequila and mezcal. And actually, the Aztecs used it to make pulque, which was the undistilled alcoholic sort of winey sort of thing that came from it. But how is agave used in cooking as an herb as well, besides in alcohol?
Well, aside from the worm salt.
Uh-huh. I got one for you. You ready?
Okay.
You're increasingly able to buy an agave syrup, which we use to sweeten a lot of our cocktails.
It's a sweetener.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah, it's great.
It's just a boiled down agave.
Agave syrup, you know, you talk about having a lot of those qualities to it. Agave syrup has, first of all, it's got a fair amount of sugars in it. Agave has a fair amount of sugars in it, so agave syrup.
That's why they can make alcohol from it.
Right, exactly. You get this sweet, I don't want to say honey-like, because it's you know, a different sweetener than honey. It's a different sweetener than sugar. It's a whole different set of flavor profile.
We did an interview with Dale DeGroff recently, who's kind of the preeminent cocktail guy in the world, mixologist, whatever you want to call him, bar chef. And he talked about sweetening drinks, and what he said that was interesting is he likes honey for certain things, but it can be too aggressive. He likes simple syrup, which is just refined sugar syrup, which is the traditional way to sweeten a cocktail. And he likes agave syrup and a few things. And what he's been doing to sweeten his drinks is to use a sweetener composed of equal parts of all three of those. And you can really taste the agave in the agave syrup.
Yeah,
it's not just bunk, you know?
Yeah, the agave syrup is actually, it's made from the nectar of the agave flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's reduced, so it's essentially like the way we make maple syrup.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's taking a liquid that has a fairly low amount of sugar, then evaporating it away until you get the concentration you want.
And just boil and boil and boil it away. Hey, listen.
Bees do the same thing to make the honey.
Bees do the same thing?
Yeah, essentially what they do is they deposit the nectar in the hive and fan it with their wings to help the evaporation.
Oh, I was trying to figure out how they got it boiling in there.
You can evaporate at different temperatures.
That's really wild. Hey, listen, Gary, it's been great having you on the show. The book is wonderful.
Fun.
It's been great. We'll put a link up to our website as how you can pick up the book. It's The Herbalist in the Kitchen by Gary Allen. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. You knew I was going to talk about agave.
I was just about to say, why do all of our shows suddenly end up talking about alcohol and cocktails, and there always seems to be something that will turn. Oh, we're having a show on eggs. We're going to talk about cage-free eggs. We're talking, and
Ramos Fizz is made of an egg white.
Exactly.
See, I can do that.
There we go.
I got a cocktail. You got an ingredient. I got a cocktail. You know, he talked about agave, which is the base fruit that makes tequila, and you can also buy now in the market agave syrup as a sweetener, which is a really wonderful and versatile.
It's interesting. What I like about it is it where simple syrup is exactly that. It's very simple and doesn't add complexity to the drink. Agave is another ingredient to add complexity, not just sweetness.
But he talked about how the agave syrup is made. Is, you know, like maple syrup, you take the maple sap from a tree. It's a very watery, mildly sweet thing, and then you boil it and boil it and boil it and boil it and boil it. And I remember reading, and they make the agave syrup the same way. But I remember reading about somebody who went up north and they were writing a piece on maple syrup, the traditional maple syrup, which is somewhat threatened by global warming and a number of other things. And he had never made syrup before. And there are all these traditions. Families that do maple syrup, and you tap the trees, and you watch your taps, and you tend them every day. And then you start the thing boiling, and you get a bunch of wood together, and you build a fire.
By the way, maple syrup is one of those things on my list that should be more expensive than it is.
Right.
You know, you build a fire out in the woods if you're making it, you know, not commercially, or even some commercial makers, and you boil and you just keep putting this stuff and you boil it down to where it's, I don't know, like a tenth, a fifth of what you started with in volume, and it's sweet. Well, this guy decided he was going to do the boiling part in his house, and so he put a pot on the stove and he just kept boiling and boiling and boiling and boiling. Well, what happened was the wallpaper started to peel off the walls. the wallboard on the ceiling started to fall in because there was so much moisture in the house. Because he basically put a big pot on the stove and boiled it at full tilt for 3 days. So my warning to you is, don't do the maple syrup or the agave syrup in a house.
There are certain things better left to those that
healthy
that
respect
do it
for the wood fire. One final note: we used to make an ingredient. We take our maple syrup and we would put it over, store it on a shelf above the wood burning grill.
Oh yeah,
and it gives you more of that smoky quality that you get from a great maple syrup. A little smoked maple syrup, magic ingredient. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott
and I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys. 1450 WCTC. It's 12 noon.